This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests, Dr. Sandra Horning and Dr. David Johnson, are cancer specialists who have also had cancer. They're the first cancer survivors to serve as president of the American Society of Clinical Oncology. Dr. Horning just started her term last month, succeeding Dr. Johnson. We invited them to talk about their experiences with cancer and cancer treatments and how that's affected them as doctors. Dr. Sandra Horning is a professor of medicine at Stanford University in the divisions of medical oncology and blood and bone marrow transplantation. She's leading a research project on Hodgkin's disease funded by the National Cancer Institute. Dr. David Johnson is a professor in medical and surgical oncology at Vanderbilt University and deputy director of the Vanderbilt Ingram Cancer Center. His area of specialization is lung and breast cancer. You're both surrounded by patients with cancer. Watching them over the years, did you worry about getting cancer yourself? Before you actually got cancer, did you allow yourself to think about and to worry about that possibility? Dr. Johnson, start with you.
No, I don't think being involved in the care of patients with cancer ever necessarily made me worry about getting cancer. My mother died of cancer at a young age when I was a medical student, so cancer had been something that I was aware of on a personal level as well as a professional level. So I wouldn't say I worried about it, but certainly it was something that I was always aware of, and certainly, you know, watched our patients struggle with their illness.
What kind of cancer did your mother have?
She had a rare form of cancer known as cholangiocarcinoma, which is a cancer of the bile ducts, the tubes leading from the liver to the intestine.
Dr. Horning, what about you? Did you worry about getting cancer after having seen so many patients with it?
No, I wasn't worried about getting cancer myself, although, like Dr. Johnson, I had personal experience in that my father died shortly after I started medical school of esophageal cancer. In my practice, I take care of very young patients, and I remember in training taking care of a patient in particular who was 16 years old and dying. And I thought to myself at that point that I would be grateful for every year of life that I had. And I maintained that attitude to the point where I had a personal diagnosis of cancer and continually afterward.
Can you each tell us a little bit about the kind of practice that you have and the kind of cancer that you had?
Well, I'm practicing at Vanderbilt University. My practice is largely geared towards patients that have lung cancer and breast cancer, but I see other forms of cancer as well, but those are the two predominant types of cancer that I see. My own diagnosis was of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which happens to be an area of expertise of Dr. Horning's. And in fact, she was one of the people we consulted back when my diagnosis was made to get some recommendations about what might be the best option for treatment during that time.
Dr. Horning?
My area of specialty is, as Dr. Johnson mentioned, in the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and also Hodgkin's disease. These are disorders that occur among the very young up to the elderly, and many of the patients in my practice are treated with curative intent so that there is a focus not only on the cure, but the least complicated cure and survivorship issues for our patients. My own diagnosis was of breast cancer 9 years ago.
Did you diagnose the cancer yourselves, or did you not know you had it until seeing a doctor?
I could start with that because I think I have one of those stories that is not all that atypical, which is that I myself detected something that was different and was concerned. I first asked my husband about it, as he is also an oncologist, and he reassured me. I then went to see an internist who performed an exam, reassured me, had a mammogram, was told that that was normal. I also saw a gynecologist who felt that there was nothing to be concerned about, but I continued to be concerned. And on that basis, actually asked a colleague of mine who's a surgical oncologist to perform an examination, which she did, and we agreed together that further diagnostic testing was in order. Afterward, the diagnosis of breast cancer was made.
I find stories like that so frightening. Because every step of the way, you were basically told not to worry until you pushed it further.
Well, I think it's an example of a story that I've heard certainly on several occasions, and it's an important message, particularly among women who are premenopausal and may have difficult breasts to examine. Mammography is notoriously difficult in younger women or women with dense breasts, and it's an important lesson if you know your body and you determine a change that you really need to carry your concern to resolution.
Dr. Johnson, did you kind of surmise yourself that you had cancer, or was that diagnosed for you?
Well, my situation is a little bit different, but I first noticed an enlarged lymph gland a week or two after Christmas. We had purchased a kitten for my daughter, and while playing with the kitten with her one evening, the cat scratched me on my leg, and a few weeks later, a lymph node developed in the groin area. There is a well-known entity known as cat scratch fever, and frankly, I thought that's what I had. So I watched this lymph node for a bit and more or less self-medicated myself for the presumed diagnosis. But after a few weeks, when things did not really improve and I began to lose some weight, I thought it warranted more careful evaluation and a biopsy. So like Sandra, I went to a surgical colleague of mine who generously offered to do the biopsy the day before we left for a little family vacation, which actually was closer to the time of my daughter's school spring break. And so he did the biopsy on a Friday afternoon, and we had left to go to a vacation. And on the following Monday, he called me to tell me that the diagnosis was lymphoma.
Did you both go through the why me kind of response after you were diagnosed? Especially, I mean, both of you, you've dedicated your lives to helping people with cancer, and then you were hit with it yourself.
You know, that's never a question I asked myself. The first thought I had was, I'm glad it's me and not my wife or my daughter. And the second thought I had, which may seem a bit odd, is that I was in some ways not glad, but thankful that I didn't have to talk to either of my parents about it. My mother, as I mentioned, had already passed away when I was a medical student. My father died when I was in my training, cancer training. And I'm not sure I could have mustered up the courage to discuss with my parents, you know, a potentially terminal illness. And I'm fortunate that I have several brothers and sisters, so I was concerned about informing them. So really, my thoughts were entirely focused on my family. I don't recall ever having thought, why me?
Dr. Horning, what about you?
Well, likewise, I never addressed the question, why me? As with Dr. Johnson, I think my greatest concerns were dealing with my immediate family and particularly my children.
There are so many difficult medical choices you have to make after you're diagnosed with cancer. And I've met so many people who felt like they had to research their own disease, going on the internet, going to the library, going to different doctors, assembling as much research as you can so you can make complicated decisions about what kind of treatment you want to get and come to some kind of understanding of what to expect. And still, those decisions are sometimes incredibly difficult to make. Being as informed about cancer as you both are as oncologists, did you still have to arm yourselves before confronting the decisions you had to make about your own cancers? Dr. Horning, let's start with you.
Well, as you indicate, I have more background knowledge than the typical patient with breast cancer. But I feel very strongly that one needs to take advantage of the expertise of those who really focus on a single disease. So I was completely prepared to put my faith and trust in individuals who were true experts in breast cancer. However, I did solicit the opinions of several experts and did some of my own background reading and brush up, since, as I indicated, I am relatively focused on the diseases that I treat. I found it difficult to pore over survival curves and wonder where I might fall on a survival curve over time. I remember also shortly after the diagnosis and as I was actually entering my treatment, being at a meeting where someone mentioned to me in the context of this meeting, which was based upon long-term complications of treatment, saying to me, well, at least with Hodgkin's disease, the disorder that I treat, one knows if he or she is cured in a short time, but if you have breast cancer, you know it can recur at any time. And those kinds of zingers still come in to haunt you.
Dr. Horning, were there any particularly difficult decisions you had to make about what treatment you were going to have? Were there any decisions where it just wasn't clear-cut and you had to struggle to make up your mind?
Well, things happened rather fast and furious at the beginning, and it was clear to me that the decision that was the most difficult for me personally, which was a major surgical procedure, had to be done. So it was clear-cut, but it was difficult. After which, I needed to make a decision together with my physicians regarding the systemic therapy, chemotherapy, hormonal therapy, or a combination that would come thereafter. And I think the only difficult decision, as it were, related to the duration of treatment and whether or not I would also receive hormonal therapy in addition to the 6 months of chemotherapy.
Dr. Johnson, I believe you opted to take an experimental form of therapy for your cancer. Can you tell us why you chose that and what the therapy was?
The therapy I received was one that was thought to be more advantageous than the so-called standard therapy at the time. And this decision was made after consulting with various individuals. One of the advantages I saw in the therapy we selected for my treatment was that it was very short. In other words, rather than the customary 6 months or so that it might ordinarily take, this particular program was completed in a period of about 3 months. I did not wish to interfere, if you will, in my practice or my career any more than I had to. So that was very attractive to me. It turns out that a study that was ongoing at that time, for which I was not eligible, but had I been, I would have joined, later demonstrated that the more standard therapy, the one we still use today, was as good, if you will, as the therapy I received, which was perceived to be a better therapy, but turned out to be no better in terms of its outcome, but somewhat worse in terms of the side effects, at least the acute side effects.
What were
there
they?
Are also, well, for me, the most severe side effect was the extreme fatigue that was associated with treatment, extreme mucositis, which is soreness of the throat and mouth, much like what one would experience after drinking a hot cup of coffee, but just magnify that by about 100-fold. So difficult that it was at times hard to even swallow saliva, much less food. And I also experienced something that doctors in our field refer to as palmar plantar syndrome or hand-foot syndrome, or there are other terms that are used, but basically the palms of your hands and the soles of your feet become extremely tender, erythematous, red, and the skin can peel off so that you it's like you've burned your hands and feet. So it was a very unpleasant and rather painful situation. The nausea and vomiting part of it was not pleasant, but I was fully prepared for that and expected that. The other side effects, of course, I knew would happen, but I think the one that was most surprising to me was the level of fatigue that I experienced. I'm a fairly energetic person, and I'm not out playing basketball or doing things of that nature, but I'm a hard worker, and that really was psychologically demoralizing to not even be able to concentrate on reading, for example, very, very effectively. So that was the part that was most surprising and difficult for me.
Dr. Horning, Dr. Johnson said one of the things that surprised him most when he had cancer was the extreme fatigue. What are some of the things that surprised you most about the symptoms that you experienced from either the cancer or the treatments?
One of the things that I wasn't prepared for, which I relate more to the diagnosis and the psychosocial aspects of having cancer rather than the specifics of treatment, was the difficulty in sleeping. I'd been told by various patients over the years about their problems with sleeping. But for me, for a several-month period of time, I could not sleep at night. And what was on my mind constantly was mortality. I think contributing to that difficulty in sleeping was that I was on a fast track to menopause, so that is a well-known side effect of entering menopause in combination with hot flashes. But that lack of sleeping paired with the effects of the chemotherapy also left me very fatigued. I definitely recall days when I simply had to put my head down on my desk because I was just too tired to continue. Other side effects that I was a bit surprised about with the specific therapy that I was taking was the fact that I lost weight rather than gained weight, which is a more common effect of that particular treatment. And I also had a fair amount of gastrointestinal difficulties, including diarrhea. So I had to work my life around basically being prepared to deal with side effects when and if they occurred.
Let me ask you the mortality question. One of the things keeping you from sleeping when you had cancer was thinking about your mortality, certainly a really obvious thing to think about. If you have cancer, there's no simple way of dealing with that. I mean, this is a reality that, you know, your life is in danger. So how did you deal with it? Sleeping pills, therapy, just kind of lying awake at night and accepting the fact that you were going to be worried?
In general, I did not take sleeping aids, and I felt, you know, that this was something that was going to pass. I did a fair amount of research as to, you know, why this might be happening, and I came to grips with what I think I was really dealing with was a grieving process. I think I was grieving for the loss of health. It is a loss, and when losses occur in various aspects of life, we're asked to deal with it. And I think when this occurs at a time in your life when you are a responsible individual, as a mother, as a wife, as a physician, or whatever, you know, you're used to being strong and and maintaining in the face of adversity. And perhaps this sleeping problem that I was having was a way that this was coming out when it could come out, which was at night.
What was it like for you to be doctors who had also become patients? Were there things you feel like you learned about what it's like to be a patient from having cancer yourself, Dr. Johnson?
Well, that's the main question I get asked all the time is, did I alter how I minister to others? And the short answer is, I don't think so outwardly. I'd like to think that I was always a good physician and one who cared and about my patients and sympathized and empathized with them. However, there is simply no way one can go through a diagnosis and treatment of cancer without having been changed. And so as much as I would like to tell you that I'm no different now than I was before, there's no question I'm different. I'm sure I'm pained just a little more when I talk to patients and I know how this diagnosis will impact them, and not just the individual, but their entire family, their nuclear family, and then their friends and colleagues. I mean, it really is like throwing a pebble in a pond. There's a ripple effect that takes place. And having experienced that, I'm sure that, you know, inside I feel that. I know I do. So I do think it's altered to some degree my approach to patients. I also think that I'm better able to describe the side effects of treatment. I've been glib at times and said one doesn't have to be shot with a bullet to know that it's a bad thing. On the other hand, if you've ever been shot with a bullet, you know it's a bad thing and you know exactly how to describe that. So I do think I have the ability to describe on a personal level what the side effects might be for an individual. But again, I would emphasize that we're much better today at controlling those side effects, and so thankfully fewer patients have to experience these types of side effects.
Dr. Horning, do you feel like being a patient changed you as a doctor?
I think my lifetime experience with cancer has enabled me to be a better physician for my patients and also for their families. Dealing with my father's cancer diagnosis and the impact of his death on my mother, my brother, and myself, going through a cancer diagnosis with my mother, not once, but twice, as well as myself, I think has given me a perspective that allows me to deal with the group that cancer affects, not just the patient, but the family and sometimes the friends as well. I feel that it has influenced me in the speed and the manner with which I would deliver test results, knowing how one is really on needles and pins waiting for that information. Like Dr. Johnson, I've always prided myself on being a sensitive physician who really cares for patients, but I do think that has given me additional ability to empathize and particularly given me insight into the emotional and psychosocial aspects of cancer diagnosis.
I'm glad you mentioned the speed of delivering test results, because it's not a big deal to get test results back to people in a timely fashion, but it means so much to the person getting the results to know whether, you know, whether you're healthy or whether you have cancer or whatever the test is for.
It was such an important issue for me as I waited to hear the results of my axillary dissection and lymph nodes, whether they were or were not involved with breast cancer. And I remember being out for a walk, a short one, as I was recovering from surgery with my husband, and we were waiting for that call. And being hailed in the driveway by someone in the house that the surgeon was on the phone with the results almost immediately as soon as they were available. And I was very appreciative of that.
And the results were that it had not spread to the lymph nodes?
That's correct.
You know, a lot of people complain that when they're a patient, that they're seen as their disease and that they're not seen as a full-dimensional person. You were mostly dealing with doctors who knew that you were doctors, and you might have already known them professionally. But did you get a taste of that feeling of being reduced to whatever the disease is that is afflicting you at that moment?
Well, I never had that feeling. But I have to say that what you are referring to, I think, is a really important part of the training of young doctors. When I was training in internal medicine at my residency program, one of the questions that the attending physician would ask us is, what is on the bedside table of the patient once we were outside of the room? And we always were required to know more about that patient's personality and their persona before illness as a part of caring for them. I love it when I'm attending in the hospital and my patients have pictures from home, especially pictures when they were well and together with other family members. It's a very important part of understanding the individual that you're taking care of.
I know of one doctor who was a specialist in breast cancer, then she had breast cancer, and after returning to her practice afterwards, she retired early and felt that she just couldn't surround herself with cancer all the time anymore, that she had to just leave the field. Both of you have stayed in oncology, and you both became presidents of the American Society of Clinical Oncology after having had cancer yourselves. Have there ever been moments in your career where you felt, I can't surround myself with this much cancer anymore, I have to get out?
Well, my response to that is that with my diagnosis and treatment, and I was confident that I was going to survive, it just intensified my desire to be involved in trying to improve the situation for patients like myself, as well as all of my patients. So if anything, it sort of intensified my ardor for what I do, and I can't imagine doing anything else, quite frankly.
Dr. Horning?
I think my feelings are very similar to Dr. Johnson's. At the time of diagnosis and particularly entering into treatment, most people do go through an assessment of where they are in life and are they happy with what they're doing and how do they want to continue. And as I evaluated, I realized that I really love being a physician, an oncologist, and I'm totally passionate about taking care of the individuals that I see with cancer diagnoses, but, you know, in particular, working toward improving outcomes, better therapies, safer therapies. Initially, when I had the diagnosis and went through treatment, I found it more difficult to deal with very desperate situations. But with time, that eased, and I think that that was directly what I was discussing earlier about the, you know, kind of constant daily thinking about your own mortality. And that is something that, at least for me, was eased with time so that I no longer think about that on a daily basis.
What are some of the ways that you think cancer treatment has changed in the past few years? And what are some of the more promising things that you can tell your cancer patients now about not only the outcome of their cancer, but how difficult the treatment is going to be?
Well, something that the public sees or reads a lot about are the so-called targeted therapies, drugs that are designed to principally attack the cancer and not impact indiscriminately on the normal tissues of the body. We're not quite there yet, but we certainly have drugs that are much more focused on the cancer, the way the cancer gains a survival advantage, if you will, that are less damaging to normal tissues. Those drugs sometimes can be used in isolation, but frankly, more often than not, they're used in combination with existing therapies like chemotherapy. So some of the perceived or theoretical advantages of the drugs with regard to side effects are not being fully realized as of yet. But the good news is we have drugs that can be used in combination that will prevent or minimize nausea, for example. We have drugs that actually can improve fatigue, not in every case, but in some cases. We have medications that can minimize the drop in the blood counts that occur commonly with chemotherapy. This is important because if one's white blood cell count falls to a lower level, you become much more susceptible to developing an infection, and the infection can be quite serious, even life-threatening. But we have medications that can minimize that risk. So over the past two decades, the improvement in supportive care medications has been really dramatic. I think if I were treated today, many of the side effects that I described to you earlier would be far less, or in some cases, maybe non-existent. So I think we're seeing real progress, not only on the therapeutic side, but in the supportive care side of treatment of cancer.
I know when I see a doctor, I like the doctor to tell me with certainty that I'm going to be okay. You know, whether it's a major or minor thing. I want to hear a confident and certain doctor that everything's going to be fine. And of course, that's not an answer you can always provide. When you're dealing with cancer patients, you're dealing with a level of uncertainty, both in terms of the outcome of the cancer and the outcome of the treatment for the cancer. We know what kind of symptoms you're going to get from the chemo itself. Uncertainty, for most of us, is really hard to deal with. So I'm wondering how you both dealt with uncertainty in your own bouts with cancer and how you deal with it as the doctor giving information to patients, knowing that there's a degree of uncertainty in whatever you can tell them.
That's probably the single most difficult thing we do on a regular basis. The reality is most physicians never have to spend a regular amount of time, if you will, discussing terminal diagnoses with their patients. I mean, even your primary care physician in his or her lifetime probably deals with only a small number of patients who actually succumb to a serious illness. That may be surprising, but that, in fact, is the reality. In our practice, this is a daily occurrence. Practice doesn't make perfect, I would add. Each case is individual. It's always difficult to convey a difficult diagnosis like cancer and the fact that someone may not survive that diagnosis. Hopefully, we all learn with time how to do that in an empathetic fashion. The fact is, all of us are born to die. That's a fact that is inescapable. We're very good at denying that fact. Most of us don't spend our day thinking about our mortality. But as Sandra pointed out, once you've had the diagnosis of cancer, that equals death in the minds of almost all of us. So all I can say is that it's a very difficult conversation that we have with each individual patient. And I can't give you a script because we don't have, or at least I don't have a script. I have to look at each patient's case individually and discuss with him or her what I perceive to be the best course of action. Of course we give hope. Hope is a very important aspect of what we provide our patients. When there is no hope left in terms of the option of curing that patient. Our job is not to provide false hope, but to smooth that passage, if you will, to one's death. That's another aspect of what we do on a regular basis.
So you see that as part of your work as an oncologist?
I think it's an absolute critical and essential part of what we do as oncologists.
Do you discuss the fact that you've had cancer with any of your cancer patients?
The answer to that is I do, but I didn't when I first recovered from my treatments.
Why did you not do it then, but you do it now?
I felt it was kind of selfish, to be blunt. But frankly, what happened is most of the nurses that I work with would tell patients, you know, Dr. Johnson has had cancer too. And I realized very quickly thereafter when patients learned that, that they wanted to know more. And so now I don't make it a point to say, you know, I've had cancer too, but if the issue comes up, I'm more than willing to discuss it in as much detail as the patient would like.
Dr. Horning, do you mention it to your patients?
I'm very selective about mentioning it for the simple reason that I do want to, you know, focus on the patient. But there are certain circumstances that arise where I think it's going to be really helpful for that individual patient to let them know that I've been through this, they can do it. And if there are, you know, particular issues that they're dealing with that I think to share my experiences would be helpful, I freely do so.
Dr. Horning, you're the present president of ASCO, the American Society of Clinical Oncology, and Dr. Johnson, you preceded Dr. Horning as president. Have either of you spoken to the members of the group about things that you've learned about the field based on being a patient and things you think other doctors need to consider based on your experiences as a patient?
Well, I'll address that this way. During my presidency, I made it a point to focus on survivorship. I'm sure that in part came from my own experience as a survivor. Actually, I asked Sandra if she would lead a task force on survivorship, which she gladly did and has done admirably and wonderfully in my view. And I'm hopeful that many of the initiatives that have been started under my term and with Sandra's help, quite frankly, will continue and will help draw even greater attention to these issues within our society.
I want to thank you so much, both of you, for talking with us. Thank you.
You're more than welcome.
Thank you.
Dr. Sandra Horning is the current president of ASCO, the American Society of Clinical Oncologists. She's a professor of medicine at Stanford University. Dr. David Johnson, the former president of ASCO, is a professor at Vanderbilt University and deputy director of the Vanderbilt Ingram Cancer Center.